Accession number 13138, row 2.
Captain Crawley, reel 2.
Yeah. Yes, I shipped up on in a trawler for Bear Island in the Arctic. And St. Leander. And of course, there was the matter then of having registration and cards, health cards, insurance, and unemployment insurance. So I went in the unemployment office and I said, "Can I have an unemployment insurance card?" So they said, "Well, why haven't you got any?" So those days, businessmen didn't need to have them, you know. I said, "Well, I've been in business, I'm a hawker." So they just give me cards, you see, and the same with the health. And when I went to sign down the fish stock, well, the chap who signed us on, Jack Wilkinson, they called him, I signed in Johnson, and he said, "What's the game?" And then he said, "Oh, it's nothing to do with me." And left it at that.
He knew you, didn't he?
Yes. So I just carried on from there, fishing, you see. There are
quite what was fishing like in the late 30s from Hull?
Rough.
In what way?
Well, for instance, you run off to the fishing grounds, you fix your net then, and I had a job in the first couple of ships, dragging coal from, you had extra coal from the fish in your after fish room to enable you to stay out for 3 or 4 weeks, 4 weeks mostly. You'd be back in just over three, but you was able to stop out about 4 weeks. And this coal in the after fish room, of course, had to be cleared, ready for fishing. So you drag it through a tunnel into the stokehold. And that was pretty hard going, because it was in two watches, six on and six off, that type of thing, that job. But when you started fishing, you rigged all the deck boards, pound boards and that. When you started fishing, it was a matter of going on and stopping on. You didn't get any break until the old man said, "Go to bed," or something like that, which was after a couple of days or something. See, but if you were slack fishing, of course, you could maybe get half an hour break or a quarter of an hour break in between hauls, you know. But it was a bit rough. I've been up three days without a regular nap there one time. And it wasn't till after the war, well after the war, that we got the hours organised to 18 on and 6 off. And that was progressive, you know. I don't know what it's like. Well, of course, it's finished now. Of course, the dock's here is finished.
So you went up to Bear Island. Anywhere else?
Oh, I was up to Bear Island. Barents Sea, White Sea and the Greenland. You carried a navigator to Greenland. You carried a coal on deck as well going to Greenland and shoveled it down, you know, in the pound loads on deck in those days. But it was a while after that. Well, at first, I met one of a pal I used to go to school with. He'd just come off a trawler, and Eddie got drowned later. I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm going to Leckenfield to build an aerodrome there." So we went out to Leckfield on a bike, and we got a job building, painting on the girders on this aerodrome. And we was there for a few weeks. We could have stayed on with them, but I took a job in one of Wilson's steamers going down to Medi as a fireman.
Which was this?
The Carlo, HMS, SS Carlo.
So you were now in the Merchant Navy in 1936?
Yeah, but it was and still under Johnson. And I did two or three, I think three more ships as a fireman. And then I went back on the deck. When was that?
And you're still doing this work when war broke out?
Well, when the war broke out, I was let's see, I was in the Elizabeth Massey when the war broke out. Yeah, that same work, as he would say, on the deck. Elizabeth Massey was a whole tramp. And we were pulled into Gibraltar. The war, I think it was just before the war was declared we pulled into Gibraltar, but we'd blacked out the port that. Well, it was the 3rd of September, wasn't it?
It was.
Anyhow, when the Navy came out, that's right, the Navy came and they asked for reservists and anybody from the Navy, so I went to the captain and I said, you better report me. He used to go short of convoy conference. Better report me and I'll give him my name and official number and that. And he said, why bother? Stay with us. Man, there was short of men in the merchant service. So when we left, he came aboard and said, the Navy don't know what to do with you here, but you've got to report when you get back home.
He told the Navy?
Yes, he reported me. So we went to Haifa. I think we went to Haifa. We went to Haifa and then to Alexandria again. But the trip after we went to Black Sea. But we got back to London to was the shipping office Poplar, where the Isle of Dogs is, those docks there. West India. And the crew were re-signing on the ship, you see, and the captain, Captain Dean, very nice chap, said to me, are you coming back in the ship? I said, well, I've got to report to the Navy, Captain. So the short of seamen in the, all of a sudden in the merchant service, because all these ships coming out of laying up and all that. And called the shipping master over, and shipping master said, well, if you've reported to the Navy, he said, they know where you are and they'll take you when they want you. Sign on here again. So I signed on and they gave me ration cards, identity cards. I couldn't prove it was me at the finish. All in the name of Johnson. So I thought, well, I like it better here. It's more free and everything than the Navy. So I carried on that basis.
Was it better paid than the Navy?
I think it would be a bit better. But of course, there's a lot of in the Navy. It's yes, I think basically there would be pay would be better, but there's a lot of fringe benefits in the Navy, sort of thing, you know. But I think the merchant service were financially better off. Of course, you was able to improve your position in the merchant service. I mean, you could go to school and get a ticket. Like if you were, I couldn't because I had no birth certificate at the time. But you could go to school and get promotion and that. Whereas in the merchant in the Navy, you probably didn't speak with the right accent, you know, or eat peas with a knife or something.
But were living conditions in the merchant service ships worse or better than in the Royal Navy?
They're about on par, I should think. Yeah, maybe about on par. Different. There was quite a difference between the conditions. I mean, you understand when you get, like on the, like on the, say the Durban. You had maybe 300 to 400 men aboard. Well, in wartime, they'd have more. Whereas in a merchant ship, you've got about 30 or 40, maybe. You see, there's quite a difference.
So, you were in the SS Elizabeth Massey
yes.
when war broke out.
Yes.
How long was it before you ran into the enemy?
Well, after the Elizabeth Massey, we came through. I went in the Nailsea Meadow, and we did a trip up to capital of the New York State, Albany, for grain. And we come through through Dover when Dunkirk was happening, you know, we heard all the explosions and all this going on, and but didn't interfere with us at all. And we birthed once again in London. So I just went home to Hull for a couple of days, and two of us had a job on a ship going to the Pacific coast of the States. Well, when we got back to London, the magnetic mines had almost closed up the East Coast, you know, at that time. They hadn't found the antidote for the magnetic mine. So the shipping on the East Coast was very sparse. So anyhow, I went across to Barry and shipped out to Barry in this tramp, the Mar Britain. She was a very old ship. They had paraffin lights in the forecastle, paraffin lights, icebox, no fridge. One of Chapman's of Newcastle.
What were living conditions like in that ship?
Well, in the forecastle, well, we call it the forecastle, the living quarters were aft and our living quarters. The firemen's were forward, I think. The firemen were coloured, West Africans. And with these paraffin lights, we called it the forecastle, but it was aft, really. It was just the living quarters, and it's accustomed to call the living quarters the forecastle, but the forecastle actually is forward. So we did one trip to the St. Lawrence with timber, come back, went to the town. And it was on the second trip out again, we was on our own, well up to the Norad in the Atlantic, when we got to Pedard. And we got to Pedard at about 11:45 midnight. And those firemen were all on the top grating, and the engineer was up calling his mate, so nobody was lost at the actual torpedoing. So
what do you remember about the impact of the torpedo?
Well, I was in my bunk and I flew out, knocked me out of my bunk. It's just like the ship being hit by a gigantic steam hammer, I suppose, at the side. And because these paraffin lights in the forecastle just flared up and didn't go out. If it'd been electric in the forecastle, there'd have been chaos. It would have shattered the dynamo down the engine room and there'd have been no lights in the forecastle. And we'd stripped off. Whereas later you got to sleeping in your full gear. At that time, you thought you was in the safety zone, you see. And you stripped off for a good night's sleep. More or less in your underwear, sort of thing. And as I say, I woke up halfway through the air. Of course, we rushed on the deck. It was needless to say, there was no panic. Like, we all took it steady. And we got on the deck, and of course, there was a lot of water on the deck from the explosion, and we thought, good God, she's going quickly. But it wasn't, it was just thrown up from the explosion, and we lowered the weather boat. We said, better get that away, because it was smashing up on the ship's side. You see, so the few men in it took it away, and we said, we'll pick you up when we come out in the other boat and share it out. And we lowered the other boat, one boat on the lower bridge, that was damaged. But we lowered the other boat and all climbed in it. And then I looked at the ship and did it. I thought was a crazy thing, you know. I thought, good God, look at her, steady. So I rushed aft, went in the forecastle, got dressed, put my sea boots, got well dressed, grabbed all the coats, blankets that I could carry, and went back and dropped them all down in the boat and then got down. And we were lying off and picked up the other lifeboat. The weather wasn't too bad then, you see, just scruffy, you know. And we shared out the crew, and when we looked, the ship all of a sudden upended and went, psh, gone. And I thought, good God, I could have been in that forecastle, you know. Yeah.
Were you in a convoy?
No, it was, and at that time, you used to go out, you used to escort you for maybe 2 days. You got 2 days from the, say, from the convoy port, which would in those days was Oban, I think, on the west coast of the state, west coast of Scotland. And we were 2 days out from there, and then the convoy lost. But when you were loaded, coming back across the Atlantic, then they escorted you the full way. Well, of course, I don't think we had the escort vessels anyhow at that time. We were turning them out pretty rapid, but that's what happened. And we were just zigzagging well up to the north, and we must have been about, I suppose we must have been about 4 days out, I forget. But when we shared the boat's crew, we said, well, we better get sailing, you see. So we took a course about west-south-west and we thought we'd head for west side of Ireland. And anyhow, the gale blew up and the boats got separated in the bad weather. And
what time of year was this?
September, October, end of September, beginning of October. It's all in the book here. Yeah, and it blew up very bad, and we couldn't sort of run before it. The seas were too big. And we put out the sea anchor and it wasn't adequate. We broached two every time and swamped the boat. And on top of that, most of the personnel were very violently seasick. They were very in a poor condition, a lot of them.
Including you?
No, there were 4 or 5 of us all right. No, I was all right. I was used to this motion in boats and in, of course, trawlers and that. And anyhow, we had to, when the sea anchor wouldn't work, we had to put the oars out to keep her head onto a sea to avoid broaching to. And you got cramp in your arms, and your forearms were like bars of iron set, you know. And in the end, we put the sail back up and lashed the bottom half to the mast, put the sea anchor out astern, and turned and ran before the wind. And it was a bit frightening to see those seas coming astern and right up, you know. And funnily enough, you'd go over them and you'd just put the tiller over and the stern into the sea, and we come along like that. And the mate says we come 550 miles. But we come along like that. And
how long did it take you to go 550 miles?
A week. So the mate said.
What were you dressed in?
Oh, I got dressed myself, but most of them had these blankets or whatever. But I had to pull my sea boots off, because it was all full of, it was wet all the time, you see. And I remembered, you remember fishing where you used these odd mittens, you know, wool mittens. And your hands were warm inside them, but all there was frost forming on the back, ice on the back. Yet your hands were still warm. And I took my gear off, and I took my fisherman's wool jersey and put down next to my skin, and the shirt and everything on top. But you was wet all the time, it just running through. Of course, we had the biggest heave. We had a bottle of brandy there. We sucked that night when we struggled with the oars. But I think the biggest sort of lift you got health-wise was condensed milk, Nestle's full cream condensed milk. And it seemed to book you up, you know, just doing it raw.
Was there much of it?
It was a case of it. I don't know how many in the case, maybe about 48 cans in the case or something like that, I think. Somebody had thrown this in the lifeboat, you see, before. But there was biscuits, although you didn't feel like eating biscuits because your water was rationed. We only had one breaker in there, where there should have been two. You see, one breaker of water, and we were very thirsty.
What's a breaker?
A keg, a small keg.
How many gallons would that hold?
Oh, I wouldn't know, really.
How many men were in your boat?
19. 19 shared out, 19 in the boat. And then those fellows that missed it in the torpedoing, well, I'll just carry on with the what happened. Yes, we were wet all the time. Our feet swelled up, like trench feet, you know, being wet all the time. We run before this wind, and we just got in the nice sailing weather, a big swell running, but not breaking, you know, and black, one black night, well, morning, about 4 o'clock in the morning, black night, and all of a sudden somebody said, there's a ship. And out of the night came this bow, cutting the water at a rapid pace. And I'd just passed the tiller to the mate, and I was stood up in the stern sheets, and it cut right through the boat, HMS Rochester. And it flung us all into the water. And I hit the ship's side and kicked out and came up on my back, and I saw this big ship. I thought, you know how a thing would look from low down in the water? It looked gigantic, and I thought, good God, it's a radar. And it disappeared into the night, and there we was swimming with a few hundred mile off land and no hope at all, really. And all of a sudden a voice said, Bill, where are you? And it was this Australian, a chap called Alan O'Season. He said, what do you... He said, I swam over and there was a few of us together, and he said, what do you think? I said, I think it's a radar, I said. I think we've had it. Well, couldn't think of anything else because, I mean, at that time, ships were ordered not to show light and that, and this Aussie said, oh, he'll come back, you'll see, he'll come back. And we were swimming there and all of a sudden a little searchlight went on and it just happened to pin on us. He'd turned and come back. And the next thing we saw was a whaler. He'd dropped a whaler and he picked us up. Picked 7 of us up out of 19. There was 12 lost in the actual collision, you see.
What condition were you in when you were picked up?
Oh, once I was picked up, it was not bad at all, really. Once I picked up and had a drink. Well, the Aussie, he took an oar in the whaler, grabbed an oar, and he said to one of the crew, give him a hand to pull them aboard. I can't have a row. And we went too bad, really. Once you had a drink and a couple of stalkers picked me up and dropped me in the bath, hot water. Good, good. The sick birth attendant come along and he said, oh, we'll put some cold water in there, you'll roast him, like. So, anyhow, we're all in the galley supping coffee with blankets round us and we wondered who'd been picked up. Well, the mate had been picked up. One of the leading seamen, when the ship stopped, when she came back and then stopped, waiting to pick us up. This leading seaman looked over the side and here's the mate, Mr. Emley, floating in the water with his head underneath the water, and the leading seaman went dived in and with a line and flashed him up and got him aboard, and he went to the hospital when we got landed. And one fireman got saved. All those who avoided death on when they were on watch, when the torpedo in, they were all lost. You know, the fourth engineer and the fireman and that. But there were 7 of us that picked up. And then she was running on the edge of a convoy, outward bound,
So there were 7 of you picked up from your lifeboat?
7 from lifeboat, yeah. The other lifeboat was spotted by a plane. A Sunderland flying boat spotted them and sent a ship to them, I think.
So they were rescued quicker than you were?
I don't know. I couldn't say about when they were rescued. I think it was before we were rescued.
Yeah. What? Is HMS Rochester a destroyer?
Sloop. She was a sloop. We were about a week on there. Went out with one convoy and picked up another convoy coming back. They were very good to us.
How long did it take you to recover from your ordeal?
Well, there was no talk of an ordeal sort of thing. Once you got picked up like that, you was all right. I mean, what affected me most was my feet. I had to buy a comfortable pair of boots to get your swollen feet down, and I think it was a short, well, you're supposed to have a month's survivor's leave, but I think I was in about a month I was back on the Harrison boat, the Harlesden.
What kind of a ship was that?
She was going out light ship to the States, we got bomb damage on the East Coast. But in those days, if you got that so much damage, then you went over the States and got it repaired in the States, you see.
Can you describe how the bomb damage occurred?
Oh, it was a miss. It was just structural damage.
This was in 1941?
41, yeah. On the East Coast we got it. We picked up a man in Methload, been in the evacuation of Dunkirk. And we're on the west side, forming a convoy to go. Well, we were formed a convoy, but we met this violent weather, very violent. And we shipped to sea, south of Skerryvore we were. Just off north of Ireland, you know. And we shipped to sea over the port quarter, and it went, washed away our boats, gun pits, everything. And this chap who'd been at Dunkirk, it washed him right over the side, and we lost him. And we put back into Glasgow as a port of refuge, and we're getting repairs done, and our articles expired, so I paid off and went home. And later that I learned that those who'd gone back in the ship, they were finished up prisoners of war. The Ghanese now got her when she left Glasgow.
What was it like on the East Coast Run in 1941?
Oh, you got the E-boat attacks, and well, you nearly always got these air raids anyhow, you know, but they weren't always successful, but we had the machine gunners come aboard and things like just for the passage up to Loch Ewe, say, up the East Coast, as additional weapons against the enemy attacks, you see, and they put a different things they're trying out, Holman projectors, which